written. If we wrote everything, well, my word, okay? The Library of Congress would be overflowing if you wrote everything that Jesus did and everything about him. And so the things that we see in this book we call the Bible are only there because they directly relate to the redeeming of mankind. We've talked about how understanding everything in the Bible reveals God to mankind, who he is, what he's like. And this is good for us. I mean, hello, we're his children. You know, what's dad like? And I don't use that flippantly, okay? What is our father like? I'm his child. I want to know what he's like. I want to follow him. I want to be like him. He is an awesome father. I want to be just like him, okay? And so this book, everything that is penned in this book, there's some aspect of God to be learned about. There's something about his nature, about his character, to be learned in every single thing, every stroke of the pen, every crossing of the T, every dotting of the I. There's something there to learn about God in some form or another, whether it's something major or something minor. There is something to be taken away there that we can apply to ourselves as his children to mold ourselves after him and our lives after him. To get a better understanding of why we got here tonight on the orange carpet. I always like it when Doug talks about being on the orange carpet, right? Because we're here for a reason. You know, this isn't just a social gathering. It's not a social club that we all just put together and we come here and thought it'd be fun to make up some songs to sing and do this prayer thing and even have Mike and some others come up here and speak some words to us. We're here for a reason. And so having an understanding of the whole plan and scheme of redemption gives us an understanding of why we're here and what it all means to us. All right, so just a quick recap. We talked about the scheme of redemption. We've also talked about viewing the Bible as one book that is split into two different things, but not in the way that we see it today. All right, normally we see the Bible is split into the Old Testament and the New Testament, the division taking place between Malachi and Matthew. And instead, I want to challenge us to see the Bible as two books that with the dividing place at Genesis chapter 3 and verse 6. Okay, the world of Genesis chapter 1 and 2, completely and utterly different in every way imaginable than what goes on from Genesis 3 until this very second here today. Two totally different worlds. The world of Genesis 1 and 2, God in perfection, man and innocence. And that's the way we've talked about viewing Genesis 1 and 2. God in perfection, man in innocence. Everything was awesome. It just simply could not be any better. It was literally heaven on earth. Okay, heaven materialized, if you will. Adam didn't lie awake at night trying to figure out, you know, how he was going to survive the next day. He didn't worry about his job. He didn't worry about his finances and how he was going to put food on the table. Everything was just there. There were no stresses. The marriage relationship was very different, free of strife, free of struggle and pain. The idea of sickness was unknown, okay? And the natural disasters that we see plaguing our earth today, unheard of, all right? All that changed, though, when sin entered the earth. So Genesis chapter 3, verses 3 through 12, we've titled as the background of redemption. And this is kind of where we've been for the past several weeks. And I'm spending a lot of time here because it's important. This is the foundation of it all, okay? The Genesis chapter 3 and verse 12 help us make sense of everything else that follows. Without a solid understanding of this, what all goes on here from the problem of sin, the ideas behind the flood, the coming of Abraham and the beginning of Israel. Without all that, the rest of the Bible just is hard to make sense of. And it's hard to fully understand and grasp. So these chapters here are critical to our understanding. And so I'm spending quite a bit of time here and we'll probably be here for next several weeks. But there's just a wealth of information in these handful of chapters. And I don't want to blow by it. All right, so here in the past week or so, we talked about how there's two main lines that stem from Adam and Eve, the righteous line of Seth and the evil line of Cain. Of course, we know that Cain killed Abel, and then after Abel, of course, Adam and Eve had other sons and daughters, but the only two that were talked about are Cain and Seth. And we looked at passages that talk about Seth's line being the righteous line, Cain's line being the evil line of, you know, one just despises and hates the things of God, one loves the things of God. And so this line begins. And eventually we see these two lines intermingle by way of marriage. The Bible tells us that the sons of men began to see the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took wives and they married. Disaster ensued. Okay, we talked about how oil and water, they just don't mix. Well, unrighteousness and righteousness, they just don't mix. Okay, it can be very destructive. And so we see this happening with the line of Seth and the line of Cain. They come, they intermingle. The sons of God are led away into immorality and violence and all kinds of just sheer insanity. And everything changed from that point on. And so it led to a lot of disaster. We looked at passages where the Bible mentioned that every intent of the thought of man's heart was only evil continually. Folks, we just don't live in that kind of world today. This was bad. All right, now we look on the news, we see the things going on, but folks, there's still a lot of goodness left in this world. Okay, there's a lot of it sitting right here. All right, this is a deep, dark, terrible situation. And so the Bible tells us that the earth was filled with violence. God looked down and he saw that the earth was made corrupt by all the violence and the evil that was going on with men. And it was just an absolute disaster. And it led to things like God being grieved in his heart, sorry that he had made man. And so he comes up with basically a plan for a divine reboot. All right. We all are computer users here today. It's kind of hard to live in this world today without having some kind of access to a computer, right? When things stop working, what is the first thing any young person will tell you to do? Just what?
Help.
What?
Kill.
Help. No. Google it. Yeah. Reboot it. Right. Just reboot. Just restart it. Give it a reboot. And so that's kind of what went down with God here. Okay, he has what I am referred to as a divine reboot. He says, I'm just going to start all over. Now, it's interesting that he did this, right? You know, he could have just wiped a whole lot of us out and said, I'm done with it. Done. We'll just go ahead and call it quits right now. But he did it. Okay, he spared mankind. He spared animal life. Okay, all through a man named Noah, and that's what we're going to get into tonight. But through this, we see the justice of God in action. We also see the long-suffering of God in action, and we see the mercy of God in action. Okay? There's a lot of things about the flood that we can learn about God. A lot of people look at the flood today, and man, they make all kinds of accusations about God of, you know, how could this great God do such a horrible, evil thing? Well, it's justice, and we all understand justice. Okay, justice is a good thing, and I doubt very seriously that you will find anyone who disagrees with that statement. Okay, without justice, man, this place would be a nightmarish place to live. Okay, if people were just allowed to roam free and do whatever they want to whoever they wanted, without repercussions, without justice, it would be a madhouse, and no one would want to live in a place like that. And so the flood is simply divine justice at work. And that's just as simple as that, in my opinion. And to some people, especially unbelievers and those who struggle with the idea and concept of God and God being a great and benevolent and loving God, that may be a difficult concept for them to grapple with. But I think if a conversation with them about justice and how we all want justice, there's a reason we all lock our doors at night, Okay? I know growing up, when I was a kid, locking the doors wasn't all that big a deal, but, well, it's kind of become that way. You know, there's a reason, though. There's a reason we have courts of law. There's a reason we have judges and police officers and keepers of the peace. Okay? They're all there to make sure that justice moves forward, that peace ensues, and that things go in a very peaceful and just manner. Okay, but so we see this terrible situation that is going on. God is grieved in his heart. He's sorry that he's even made man, but he decides to spare man and animals through a man named Noah. And so let's meet Noah. Can I get a reader? Genesis chapter 6, verses 8 through 9.
When Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord, Noah was righteous and blameless in his hand. Noah walked with God.
All right. Why is this such a monumental statement? Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his time. Noah walked with God. Now listen, again, let's keep in mind the background here, okay?
Was Noah the only person that found favor in the eyes of the Lord?
Good question. It's a very good question. We'll talk about that more here in just a second. Why is this such a monumental statement?
He hadn't walked with anybody since sin.
I'm sorry?
He hadn't walked with any man since sin.
Okay.
He was unleashed on the earth.
He had not walked with any man. This is Noah or God?
Which,
God had not walked with any man like this since sin was unleashed on the earth? Okay. To some extent, perhaps, Enoch was such a man, right? Enoch walked with God. And I think we can see that the whole line of Noah is really a good line, right? He comes from a long line of very godly people. Seth obviously had God instilled in him through Adam and Eve, all right? And that was clearly passed down through onto Noah. But it's interesting here, again, at this point, as we discussed a few weeks now, but we talked about how it's been about 1,500 years now since Noah came on the scene. It's around 1650, or the earth, rather, had been around. Creation had been around for about 1,650 years when the flood came. And so a lot can happen in 1,600 years. You know, look at what just all has taken place in the past 240-ish years of our nation. Tremendous growth as far as mankind is concerned. And so, you know, we look back and see what's just taken place over the past 20 years of our life. Unbelievable technological advances and on and so on. So you can imagine by the time 1,500 years has passed, a lot has gone on. A lot of water has flowed under that bridge, as we sometimes say, right? It could have been a lot of technological advances. Mankind had learned a lot. You know, there's a lot to learn in 1,500 years of time. And so there's also a tremendous amount of growth. You know, we might be able to safely assume that there were millions of people on the face of the earth by that time. That's a long period of time, folks. All right? And so for Noah to find himself in that situation with perhaps millions of people on the face of the earth, and for God to look down and say, man, that's the only righteous guy there. Are you kidding? That is a monumental statement to be said about a man. And so this is the kind of man Noah was. Well, what was different about Noah? Well, it'd probably be safe to assume that Noah did not mix himself up with unrighteous people as his other family members did. All right? Clearly the rest of his line was led astray. And I mean, if we're going to sit here and talk about that the every thought and every intent of man's heart was nothing but evil continually, we're talking about some of Noah's family too. But somehow Noah was able to avoid that. All right? And so clearly he did not mix himself up with unrighteous people and people who did not follow and fear God as he did. And so he remained faithful to God. He obviously had parents who led him to God. By this time, his parents had gone. The only family member of his that was still around by the time the flood period came here was Methuselah. And we see that Methuselah died the same year of the flood, by just the chronological ages that we see. So we're kind of left with two options, and we discussed this a handful of weeks ago, that Methuselah also died in the flood. Or it's just possible that Methuselah died before the flood even started, just of old age. He was 900-something years old, oldest man in the Bible. It's quite possible that he just died of old age before the flood even hit. I don't know. We're just kind of left to speculate there. But I would assume that I would make the assumption that he died simply prior to the flood ever coming. Because if coming from that line, I don't know. I just feel it's a safe assumption that Methuselah was probably an upright man. But Noah obviously had parents who led him to God as well. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 5 refers to Noah as a preacher of righteousness. All right, and so now we're never really told much about Noah preaching and Noah trying to reach out to people and try to share the gospel, or not the gospel necessarily, but you know, the to share God with others. We're never really told that, but he is referred to as a preacher of righteousness. So we kind of have to assume that at some point in time he was talking about God to somebody, okay, and trying to convince people to, look, y'all need to stop this. Y'all need to change your ways, all right? So the question is, do you think that God would have spared anyone else who repented during the 120-year span?
Absolutely.
He absolutely would have. You can bet on it, all right? Hank brought this up just a bit ago, but you know, we're never told that Noah's wife, his sons, nor his sons' wives are upstanding and righteous people. We could assume so, right? We could assume that maybe they were, but that's not what the Bible says. The Bible says that Noah was looked down and God said, well, that's about it.
Follow-up question. Noah was a preacher.
Okay.
He got no positive response if there was no one who
offended him. Sure, yeah. It's very possible to go around preaching the gospel and not get good response, isn't it?
Yes.
Definitely had to have the family to continue the livelihood of mankind to procreate, for sure, absolutely. But, you know, is it possible here that they were spared because of Noah's righteousness? Yeah, sure. All right, and that's something for us to keep in mind. All right, folks, we just never know.
What happens afterwards would seem to be worse.
Yeah.
Noah's.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get into what happened after the flood here in a week or two. Disaster, for sure. We're going to hold that thought if that's all right with you. All right. So, yeah, we can assume that perhaps they were good people, but we're just not told that. You know, all we're really told is, man, Noah was a great guy. And God looked down and said, Noah's it. That's all I got. Yeah, that's right. Sin was on the ark, for sure. All right. So Genesis chapter 6, verses 13 through 22. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on the ark and everything, but I don't want to get too deep into it all. So we're just going to kind of glaze over it some. So God gives Noah the instructions for the ark. It says it's to be made from gopher wood. There's a lot of ideas out there on what gopher wood is. Some people may know what gopher wood is. Some going back and doing studies of the Hebrew word itself and all this kind of stuff. They've come up with all kinds of ideas. Maybe it was cypress wood, or maybe it just meant a wood that was cut into square beams. You know, is kind of, some say that's what the Hebrew word there kind of lends itself to. Go figure. One hand or another, I don't know. I'm not going to disfellowship no one over an argument of gopher wood. But it was to be made from gopher wood. It was to have rooms. It was to be covered inside and outside with pitch. Its dimensions, 300 cubits long, 50 cubits wide, 30 cubits high. We've often heard, I'm sure, that the cubit was the average length from an elbow of a man to the tip of his middle finger. Okay, approximately 18 inches is what I've always been taught and what I've always been heard. It was to have a window, one cubit from the top, and a door in the side of it, and it was to have three different decks. That was the essential layout of it all and how it's supposed to be done. So let's put it into some perspective that we can understand, all right? There's your length, width, and height in feet. 450 feet long, so 150 feet longer than your average football field, 75 feet wide, 45 feet high. The Titanic, 882 feet long, 92 feet wide, and 175 feet high. And the largest passenger ship that we have today is the Royal Caribbean, Allure of the Seas, according to my Google search. Somebody said just Google it, okay? 1,187 feet long, 198 feet wide, and 236 feet high above the water. I couldn't find a height from the bottom to the top. So from the water line up, 236 feet. By the way, that ship does have a sister ship. This one is 2 inches longer, though. They're built to the same specs, but this one happened to be 2 inches longer. So biggest ship we have in the world today. So as you can see, you know, it's a much smaller boat than what we are used to today. But way back then, that was a big boat, okay? If that boat were still lying around today, it would be one of the modern wonders of the world, okay? Because we all can't help but ask, how in the world did Noah build that thing? If you were to tell me to build a ship like that, that's not going to happen. Gary could probably do it. Gary can do anything, but. Well, that's true too. That's true too, John. Absolutely. That's right. You always turning me down on my chocolate too. Yeah, that's the biggest passenger ship we have, yeah. I don't know, as far as the biggest just ship in the world, I have no idea. That's the biggest passenger ship that we have today. According to an Apologetics Press article, everybody know who Apologetics Press is? Anybody who doesn't know who they are? If you don't, that's fine. They're a group. They're based in Montgomery, Alabama. They're affiliated with the Churches of Christ. They're mostly a lot. There's some of them are scientists. Other of them are just biblical scholars. And they it's a nonprofit organization that spends a tremendous amount of time and resources and efforts proving the facts of the Bible. Okay, they do a lot of scientific research, bring a lot of science data together, Bible data together, make them harmonize. They do a tremendous amount of work, and they're a tremendous organization within the Brotherhood. And I simply can't say enough about them. I got a couple of friends that are authors and some of their core staff members. Wonderful men, wonderful people, and they do a tremendous amount of work. Tremendous amount of info and materials out there if you ever need any resources. A load of it on their website, and they're just awesome. Anyhow, this is an article on their website called it's titled "An Examination of Noah's Ark and the Global Flood." It's by Bert Thompson and Brad Harrob. This article was written a long time ago, and I've heard them do a number of different talks and sermons and stuff preached on this topic from men at Apologetics Press. So I pulled a lot of information in my study tonight from this article here. And if anybody wants it, I know that's a long thing to be writing down, but I'm more than happy to email it to you if you'd like it. Anyhow, so according to the Apologetics Press article, the Ark had enough space to transport 10 freight trains pulling 52 standard boxcars each. Okay, so that's a total of 520 modern-day boxcars could fit inside the Ark. That's huge. Okay, that is a lot of space. The total area, I assume this is probably floor space, was just by conservative measures. Okay, this is going off a cubit here. You know, just based on our historical data and that we research that we've had, conservative estimates, approximately 95,700 square feet, so about 20 standard basketball courts worth of floor space in this thing, and a total volume of approximately 1.4 million cubic feet. Again, a lot of space, okay? A tremendous amount of space. Very, very large vessel. All right, so what about the animals on the ark? Genesis 6, 19 through 20. Would anybody like to read?
Keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of the birds after their kind, and of the animals after their kind, of every creeping thing on the ground after its kind, two of every kind will come to you, keep them alive.
There's one for you and your lovely wife. How about that?
Keep them alive. Does that mean feed them?
Yes. Genesis 7, 1 through 3. I got another reader.
Then the Lord said to Noah, enter the ark, you and all your household, for you alone I have seen to be righteous before me in this time. You shall take with you every clean animal by sevens, a male and his female, and the animals that are not clean, too, a male and his female, also the bird in the sky by sevens, male and female, to keep offspring alive on the face of all the earth.
Oh, all right. Thank you. Oh, sorry, Mary. All right. So birds, animals, and creeping things were all to be gathered on the ark. We're talking about land-dwelling animals here, okay? The things that lived in the water, they were going to be in the water, okay? So there's a lot of animals that could successfully live in the water. But so we're dealing with land animals, birds, animals, and creeping things. So we're talking about worms and insects too, okay? Anything that lived on land. Some of them were going to be on the ark. Genesis 6, verse 20 tells us that the animals would come to Noah. You know, there's a lot of skeptics out there, who unbelievers, who will say, well, that's just impossible. There's no way on this earth Noah could have gone and rounded up all those animals and got them on the boat. That's just the most ludicrous, stupid thing I've ever heard in my life. Well, the Bible don't say he did that. All right, the Bible says that the animals came to him. As John said earlier, God was with him. Okay, and we're going to see this as you go on. Or as we go on through this study, God was definitely with Noah and was a heavy part of this whole bout. So Noah didn't have to go do some kind of great roundup, riding his horse, rounding up animals and all this kind of stuff. It says that they came to him. Noah was to take animals after their kind. Okay, there's skeptics out there too who will tell you that that's just impossible for Noah to fit that many animals on that boat. Not really. Okay, again, as we've seen, That was a large vessel, okay? That was a gargantuan ship. But it never says that Noah had something of every type of animal on the face of the earth. It said that he was to take animals after their kind. So the idea is here, you know, for going for the canine route, he didn't have to have two German Shepherds, two Labradors, two Poodles, two Wolves, two Coyotes. It was just two of the canine clan. Okay, so he could have had a wolf and a coyote on there as far as we're concerned, okay? That was the two. All right, so you can get into some deep scientific talks on all that kind of stuff if you want. I'm not going to. But the Bible simply says he was to take animals after their kind. So again, we're just looking at kinds. We all understand. We've all had the science class stuff. We understand species, kinds, all this kind of stuff. So two things of the canine, two things of the feline, so on, so on, so forth. It just simply had to be two of that type, at least of the unclean. Of every clean animal by sevens, a male and female. Now, this is my opinion on this one, okay? Amazingly, there's a big debate over this. There's a big debate over whether there were just seven clean or whether there were 14 clean. I find it rather humorous. To me, it seems rather obvious there were 14. That's just my opinion on the matter. All through this, it's male and his female, male and his female, male and his female. He took them by two. He took them by two. You know, we see it mentioned multiple times in these couple of chapters here. So my thoughts on it, Kirk's opinion, of the clean, there were 14. Okay, two pairs, seven pairs, a male and a female, all on the ark. Of the unclean, one pair, a male and his female.
You were doing good until you made that statement.
Uh-oh. What'd I do now, Lex?
Well, up at the top it says, every clean animal by seven, so male and female,
yeah.
And you came up with 14. Down at the bottom it says, every unclean animal, how do you get one pair?
A male
and a female. Where did the one pair come from?
The unclean, a male and a female.
Not two, just like the other?
One pair. You and Edith are a pair. You're not unclean.
Sometimes we're all.
Hey, Jesus changed us
clean.
That's a great question, and I asked that myself. If we go and look at the old law, there's a lot of deep details on what's considered clean and unclean. To this point in time, I haven't seen it. Mike, do you have an answer for that one? I don't either. We're kind of left to guess here. And we might be able to refer to some of the stuff that we see in the old law as what could have been considered clean and unclean. I don't know that the clean and unclean standards that we see in the Levitical law would necessarily fully apply here, because that law didn't exist yet. But it might at least give us an idea of what's being discussed as clean and unclean. But at this time, we simply haven't been given a lot of detail on what that would be. Any other questions, comments on this? All right, so final preparations for the flood. 120 years has passed, the ark has been built, and things are, the flood is finally starting to get into motion. Can I get a reader for Genesis 6, 21 through 22?
As for you, take for yourself some of all food which is edible, and gather it to yourself, and it shall be for food for you and for them. I guess it's referring to the animals.
Yes.
Thus Noah did according to all that God had commanded him, so he did. So that answers my question.
Yeah. I can't remember the full context here of those verses. You could make the case that he could have been talking about Noah's family, but if I'm not mistaken, the context was there discussing animals, and him and the animals. And so, yeah, that would be food for Noah, his family, and the animals as well. What about Genesis 7, verses 1 and also verses 1 through 6? I've got them all combined there, separated by the ellipsis. Anybody like to read that long passage?
Then the Lord said to Noah, enter the ark, you and all your household, for you alone I have seen to be righteous before me in this time. For after 7 more days I will send rain on the earth, 40 days and 40 nights, and I will blot out from the face of the land every living thing that I have made. Noah did according to all that the Lord had commanded him. Now Noah was 600 years old when the flood of water came upon the earth. Then Noah and his sons and his wife and his son's wife with him entered the ark because of the water.
All right, thank you. All right, Genesis chapter 7, verse 15. Somebody else like to read.
So they went to the ark to Noah by twos of all the flesh in which was the breath of life. Those that entered, male and female of all flesh, entered as God had commanded them, and the Lord closed it behind them.
And that sort of answers the question. You said your opinion up there before, whether it's 14 or 7 pairs.
Yeah.
It has to be an even number.
Right. Again, this is one there. There are probably at least somewhere between 3 to 5 different instances in between chapter 6 and 7 that speak of them going in by pairs. And so it just seems obvious to me that there were 7 pairs for a total of 14 animals. But again, believe it or not, there's a rather big debate out there on whether it was just 7 or 14. But I'm of the 14 persuasion. So we see here that the Lord closed it behind him. Again, why is this an important statement? Okay, so they all get on the ark, all the animals, they all up on the ark. His family's on the ark. Why didn't Noah Noah and his sons grab a big rope and, you know, pull that door closed? Why is it important that the Lord closed it behind him? What does that show us? God's in control. It's his plan. He's involved, right? He is very much a part of it. He's not just sitting idly by, you know, He didn't give this instructions to Noah and say, go get it, buddy. You know, have at it. You got it. God was very much involved. And John alluded to that a bit ago. You know, we sit here and ask, well, how in the world did Noah do all this? It can be done with God. And we see that God was very much involved in this whole matter. And this is including the animals as well. Okay? God was concerned about the animals. All right? There's a reason they're on the boat. Okay? He got them on there as well. And so, you know, we can make the argument that, that he had to do that for sustaining the livelihood of man one day. They had to have something to eat. Maybe not. We'll talk about that here in another couple of weeks. But nonetheless, we can see that God was definitely very much involved in a part of this matter. All right, so the flood begins, Genesis 7, 17 through 20. Would somebody like to read?
Got a lot of reading tonight.
Then the flood came upon the earth for 40 days, and the water increased and lifted up the ark, so that it rose above the earth. The water prevailed and increased greatly upon the earth, and the ark floated on the surface of the water. The water prevailed more and more upon the earth, so that all the high mountains everywhere under the heavens were covered. The water prevailed 15 cubits higher, and the mountains were covered.
All right.
A lot of water, huh? You know, we can ask, where did all that water come from? You know, was it all by the rain? A lot of ideas out there on that. I can tell you this, you all have seen the great floods that have taken place around this country and around this world. You let it rain for a solid week, bad things start happening. Mississippi River, Ohio River, we've all seen them things flood and do some crazy stuff. New Orleans, bad hurricane comes through. Okay, we've all seen it happen. We've seen all the mudslides here in the past couple years out in California. Out west, you know, a lot of rain comes through, man, all kinds of destruction starts taking place. So you can imagine a solid rain for 5 weeks, so, you know, over a month, nonstop. That's a lot of water. However, the Bible goes in and tells us, too, that the windows of heaven were open, that the fountains of the deep were open. We're kind of left to wonder what that might be. And we can come up with all kinds of ideas. Apologia Express has a lot of good ideas out there. One cool idea I've heard is that in the beginning, the earth was somehow surrounded by a dome of water. Okay? I don't think it can be scientifically proven that this was the case. But there are people out there who speculate that the earth was covered by a dome of water. And there are some biblical passages that kind of lend to this idea. There's also have been some scientific discoveries that kind of lend to this. You know, there's been the discovery of woolly mammoths caved and buried in ice in very northern Polish areas of the earth that have vegetation in their mouth still and in their stomachs. You know, how do you explain that? Frozen wastelands. You know, we've all seen the videos and pictures of the Arctic. I've never seen anything growing there. You know, but we have found animals there, it seems, with vegetation still caught in their stomachs and in their mouths, okay? Again, it's been a long time since I've read up on all that, but I have. And things like that can only be truly answered and made sense by a massive flood, okay? When big floods happen like this, life tends to be taken very quickly, okay? And buried very quickly, okay? If you think of mudslides, a big wash of mud and trees and everything else, rocks, all coming down a hill, entombing immediately a load of animals, which could answer a lot of questions about our dinosaurs, could answer a lot of questions about how we just find fossils perfectly laid out. You know, you take a massive animal, immediately bury it under rock and mud, and this, the pressures that continue to build up on that thing, here we are thousands of years later seeing the evidence thereof. So the flood really answers a lot of stuff for us from a scientific point of view. And there's a lot of great material out there, especially from Apologetics Press, if you want to go read more about it. They have a wealth of information on the subject of the flood and fossils and all that kind of stuff, dinosaurs and everything. But here we see that the flood has started and the waters have risen. Going back to what I was talking about, this dome of water, right? Prior to this, we never hear of rain. The Bible never speaks of rain, okay? In the beginning, it says that the ground was watered by a mist. We're never told that it rained prior to the flood. Suddenly, the flood comes, and all of a sudden, it's raining all the time. You know, there seemed to have been some kind of change there with the flood. I don't know. Cool stuff to think about. All right, so the water prevailed 15 cubits higher, and the mountains were covered. Another cool thing that Apologetics Press has pointed out and that I found fascinating, and to me just goes again to show that God was involved here, okay? I am by no means a shipbuilder, but apparently if you're building a boat that's built for seaworthiness and carrying massive loads of cargo, okay, the standard calculation for figuring the draft of the boat, okay? The draft of a boat is how deep it sinks into the water when fully loaded, okay? A speedboat has a very different draft than an oil tanker, okay? Supposedly, the standard calculation for a boat built for seaworthiness and carrying large cargo is half its height when fully loaded, okay? You fully load the thing down, it sinks half its height into the water. The ark was 30 cubits tall. That passage in Genesis says that the waters prevailed 15 cubits above the highest peak, and the mountains were covered. What does that tell you, folks? The water was deep, but God was involved. To me, if we take this idea of the draft of the ark being, you know, half its height, folks, that is sheer precision and the hand of God at work. Yeah, he tells Noah exactly, I want this thing built 30 cubits high, and the water prevails 15 cubits higher than the mountains. God flooded the earth to such a point that the ark would not hit bottom. Folks, that is precision. That is the hand of God. And I just, you know, when we think about Moses writing Genesis, there's no way on this earth he could have just made that up. And I find it hard to believe that Moses would have had the wherewithal to say, oh, this will be fun, you know. Or if anybody else writing this book would have had the wherewithal to come up with something like that. Folks, this is the hand of God at work. And I love these little pearls like this in the scripture. Man, they just excite the daylights out of me because you can see God there. It helps to authenticate this book. You know, who's going to come up with that kind of stuff? No one but God. Okay, this is detailed stuff here that people just aren't going to make up. And so when we see this, we can see that God was definitely at work here and that his hand was there with Noah and with everything that was on that ark. God was with Noah. Here's some famous mountains heights. Mount Everest, 29,000 feet, 5.5 miles tall. K2, 5.3 miles. McKinley, 3.8 miles. Kilimanjaro, 3.6 miles tall. These are big mountains. And when you think about the flood, it's like, man, did it really prevail 5.5 miles upward? Maybe, maybe not, right? Based upon what we read earlier, what questions do these numbers raise? Do these seem like tremendous heights to be covered in water? It does, right? The flood over 5.5 miles deep. Let's go to Psalms 104. Can I get a reader? Verses 5 through 9. Anybody, anybody, anybody.
So that it will not totter forever and ever. You covered it with the deep, as with a garment. The waters were standing above the mountains. At your rebuke, they fled. At the sound of your thunder, they hurried away. The mountains rose, and the valleys sank down to the place which you established for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass over, so that they will not return to cover the earth.
All right, so there's some debate out there on what this passage is referring to, and the debate generally is that it could be talking about two things, creation or the flood. Okay, and they say creation because, you know, he established the earth upon his foundation so it will not totter forever. You covered it with the deep. You know, if we remember back to the, you know, Genesis 1 and the initial account, it was just, you know, it was void without form. Spirit of God hovered over the face of the waters, and then God said, let there be this, let there be that, and the water separated, the firmament rose, blah, blah, blah. But this also sounds very much like the flood, right? And so it could be talking about both things. This could be just the psalmist talking about the activity of God in previous centuries. So he says that you covered it so that it will not totter forever. You covered it with the deep as with the garment. The waters were standing above the mountains. Sounds very similar to what all these passages we've just been reading, right? At your rebuke they fled. The mountains rose. The valley sank down to the place where which you established for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass over so that they what? Will not return to cover the earth. What was the promise God made to Noah? I will never do this again. Okay? It sounds very much like the flood is being discussed, right? So, an interesting thing here that I saw in this passage was the mountains rose and the valley sank down. It kind of lends to the idea that perhaps God restructured the earth after the flood. That was a tremendous amount of water that had to go somewhere. Now, if we read on in the Genesis account of the flood, it talks about how God caused a strong wind to come to blow the water here and there, and different things that God did to displace the water and make everything settle back out. But still, nonetheless, tremendous amount of water. This passage here kind of lends to the idea that God may have raised new mountains, that God may have pushed down new valleys. Okay, as far as we know, the earth was completely and utterly restructured after the flood. Again, we have seen the mighty Mississippi reroute itself. Ohio, some of these major rivers that flood quite frequently, they don't have the same path they did 50 years ago or 100 years ago. And another 50, 100 years, they probably still won't have the same path. These things are ever changing because of just what water can do. Okay? It's my opinion that... Sorry?
Rise and
parts of Florida are going to be underwater. Okay. In so many years. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. I don't know. But all I'm saying is that this passage kind of lends to the idea that God may have, again, speculation, may have completely and utterly restructured the earth at the flood. He may have raised up new mountains, pushed down new valleys. And these valleys may be what we know as the Pacific Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, the Mediterranean Sea, you name it. Okay? Gary?
Well, even at the Orlando Wetlands Park, we find shell or road base, and the shell just didn't get there on its own.
Yeah.
If the earth was covered
sure.
with water, this would be
yes.
And yeah. I've taken people and showed them entire conchs that we dug out with excavators.
Sure.
And they still look at you like, yeah.
Don't you know the Indian brothers again?
Yeah. Yeah. And then also, yeah, and then you go to some museums around here, and a lot of the Native Americans use the large conchs as carpets.
Sure.
Hey, I don't know.
Yeah,
you gotta get it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well,
could it be also there that as the water evaporated with soap in and so forth, and it went down, and it appeared that the mountains were rising up and without it?
Sure. Yeah. I'm certain the natural processes of the water cycles took place. Yeah. Sure. Sure. Yeah, no doubt. Again, this is all just ideas of speculation, just for our own interest. Bob? I haven't gotten there yet. I ain't got that far, Bob. I'm going to get to the rainbow. I love the rainbow. I hadn't gotten there yet, though. So yeah, that's the end of our time, though. So we'll pick up there next week. Thank you so much for your comments and your questions and all that kind of good stuff. It's been good.